We tell stories to share the human experience.
No matter what form it takes.
Actor, photographer, theatre maker, musician, whoever is trying to be heard.
We can't stop telling stories. There's no end to them.
By telling stories, we connect to each other and create a sense of community.
This is an opportunity to share stories from a talented and diverse range of individuals, in the hope it provides inspiration and knowledge.
This is a podcast about Australian storytelling in all its forms, hosted by two Australians in the arts industry.
Welcome to the Act of Storytelling.
Hi, everybody.
I'm Lauren Bailey.
And I'm Nick Kane.
And thanks for listening.
Welcome to the December 2014 edition of the podcast. And it's hard to believe it's been almost a year of sharing people's stories and our stories with you.
11's my lucky number.
Is it?
So we better make this one good.
This will be a beauty. I guess the best way to start is with lucky Lauren. Tell us about your month.
It's been a really fantastic month and full of lots of different sorts of projects. I feel like this month has been particularly full of a whole range of different types of storytelling, film, theatre, visual art, poetry, music.
Fantastic.
So where to start? Okay, so just after we went live with last month's podcast, I don't know if our listeners remember, but I did a bit of a shout out supporting Australian work.
Yes, see films.
Yes.
Australian films.
Well, not just films, but...
Yes, artistic work.
Films are a great start.
Yep.
And so I was lucky enough to go to the Australian premiere of The Mule.
Yes.
That was screening at Acme.
Fantastic. How did you go?
Well, for anyone who's not familiar with the film, it's co-written by Angus Sampson and Lee Whannell and co-directed by Tony Marnie and Angus Sampson. Anyway, it's got Hugo Weaving in it. It's just a fantastic project. And it's about a first-time drug mule who's caught by law enforcement and who attempts to withhold the evidence.
Yes. Within his stomach, yes.
And it was really great to go along to, you know, it's just been shot in Melbourne, in and around Sunshine and sort of West Melbourne. So it's always nice when something's that close to home. It was very well produced.
Definitely.
But to start off, I sort of felt like I know this story. But then it all changed.
You know, I was going to mention that because I did have an opportunity to watch it as well because I thought if we're going to...
After the virtual premiere.
Correct. Exactly. I got it on digital download. And I tell you what, you're exactly right. There's a heap of surprises throughout this film. And I loved someone had mentioned that it was a brown comedy, which I quite enjoyed that analogy of it. I'll let the listeners decide why. The writing was fantastic. There were surprises along the way which you didn't see coming, which I loved.
But just really nice reveals, you know, like I guess because of Angus's comedy, I was maybe expecting more of a farce going in.
Yeah.
But there was a really nice level of reality.
He totally sat within that character and allowed it to happen around him, didn't it? Which was fantastic. Yeah.
So I definitely recommend that to anyone. They had the virtual premiere. They pretty much went straight from a few cinema screenings, but then straight to video on demand. And it hit number one on independent new release on iTunes in the US in its first week, which is really
fantastic.
Exciting. So you can check that out, and I guess we'll put a link on the website. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that was straight after we recorded.
Yep.
Other things that happened, I mentioned Yvonne Fletcher, who I ran into last month, and I actually ended up having a healing session with her.
Wow, it's amazing.
At the start of this month.
So what did that involve?
I guess it was a bit of a personal experience. I don't want to get too much into it.
Yeah, I understand.
But the reason I was keen to do it was this idea of letting go of conscious and unconscious negative beliefs that might be holding me back.
Mm-hmm.
And I definitely felt like that was a success.
Great.
And I sort of have more clarity and feel a bit, I guess, cleaner, you could say.
Yeah, clarity is a nice thing.
So that was the start of my month. And then, of course, everything happened right after we went live with the last podcast. We went to the opening of Kafka's Monkey.
Yes, we did.
Which
amazing.
I think we should talk a bit about that because I thought it was such a beautiful production.
Beautiful, well crafted, amazing, amazing effort from Boris as well, who was the lead actor in that. It came together superbly.
And we were lucky enough to see it twice. We got to see it later in the season. I mean, it's it's great to be able to see multiple viewings of any show, but particularly one, the way he'd sat in the performance and the way it had shifted just really in really subtle ways. I just felt like it revealed different parts of the story.
Yeah, exactly.
It was fantastic. That
you're right. Shone the light on different parts of what they were trying to do with that particular showing. Yeah.
And from talking to him, it sounded like that happened a little bit each night. New bits would be revealed, which is, I guess...
Beautiful.
Yeah, what you want, which is great. I finished shooting of the feature film that I was in.
Well done.
Shooting in.
Well done. Pat on the back for you.
Yay, thank you. But I just want to do a shout out to the wonderful writers, producers, Vinnie Serra, Lynette Malato and Michael Mazziotta. And of course, the fantastic director, Simone Albonu, for such a great opportunity. So thanks, guys. What else? Oh, I went to Queensland this month. I don't know if anyone saw. I posted a bit online. But so I went up to Queensland primarily for my great uncle's 90th birthday.
Oh, nice.
But I was hoping while I was up there to see a bit of art and, you know, get a sense of what's happening in the community up there. And I did see some really great exhibitions at the Queensland Art Gallery and GOMA, but I'll talk about them, part of my recommendations, other side of the podcast.
Great.
But I do want to talk a little bit about my great uncle.
Oh, fantastic. Yes, please.
Because my mum's from Queensland, so we've got lots of relatives up there, and I used to go up there a lot more when I was younger and would visit my great uncle, and it was always a real adventure. He used to be a drover.
Oh, nice.
And he has
Aussie heartland.
Yeah, he has a property up there. And, you know, as a teenager, it was just amazing. We'd go up and we'd traipse around the farm and we'd feed the chickens, and he'd have visitors drop by all day. And then in the evening, we would gather on the veranda and sit and listen spellbound while he recited Australian bush poetry.
Oh, fantastic.
And going up there to celebrate his 90th birthday with him was just a reminder of what an inspiration that had been for me. And I consequently have memorized some of the poetry that he recites.
Oh, great.
Although I, you know, his voice and the way he personifies the stories that he's telling and evokes the harshness and the beauty of the Australian landscape. I recorded a little bit when I was up there this time, and if I can edit it together properly, I'm going to pop a little bit into this month's podcast just to pay tribute to him.
Do you reckon right now? As in, like, can we play it right now?
Yeah, like, as in I'll put it in here.
The spirit of the West is dead. Old Cameron said that night while yarning on the homestead porch when western stars were bright. This life we lived has gone for good, he said, and this I know. The last remaining wrinkle passed when we old timers go. These lads are fine when all goes well. But when there comes a pinch, he'll find them pulling at the reins to swerve aside or flinch. A droving man in youth he had been, and now by range and creek, his vast herds roam the miles untold. So well might Cameron speak. Next day beyond those Gidgee yards, the restless cattle broke, and Cameron thundered to the lead. Before those echoes woke, at a racing pace between the trees, his stout roan stock horse strode, with hooves that whistled through the grass. And oh, how Cameron rode! He turned the spreading vanguard in, but as he gathered rein, a wild bull charged him from the side and threw him to the plain. And the old man stricken strove to rise, but with a muffled roar, the wild bull, maddened for the kill, lowered his head to gore. And racing down that pot-holed plain, the race that madmen ride, with blood beads forming on his spurs, young Danny reached his side. No time to use the stock whip there, and springing as the wildcat springs, he landed on the wild bull's head, to nose and horn to cling. And stockman racing to the scene saw him twist and reef, without a ghostly chance to throw that raging ton of beef. They saw that great head dip and toss, and those white horns arching wide. And on that broken skidgy flat, the gay young stockman died. And old Cameron rose on shaken limbs, the old bowl breeder game. Warm blood seeped beneath his shirt, red as the sunset flame. And while crashing through the undergrowth, they heard the wild bull go. For the spirit of the West lives on, old Cameron murmured low. Well, I haven't got the voice tonight.
So Queensland was really wonderful, and I finished off my month helping out last week in the production office for feature film Downriver that's just been shooting in Melbourne. It was funded by Screen Australia. It's writer and director Grant Sicluna's first feature, produced by Happening Films, and it starring Puberty Blues, Reef Island, and also Kerry Fox. Mm-hmm. And that was just super exciting. You know, I got coffees and did all sorts of things, but it was
the process.
Great to be on that side of events too. Yeah. And yeah, that was lots of fun. This month has just been so full of very different stuff. So last but not least, yesterday I went back to ACME to one of the program screenings for the VCA Film Masters students. Because if you recall, in I think it was July, I was on-set acting coach for The Phoenix by Nora Niasari, which screened yesterday at ACME.
Oh, fantastic.
So I got to see the finished product.
How cool. How was it received in the room?
I think it was received well. I couldn't really tell. Like I was involved. I was beaming. How did you know?
Yeah.
I was too involved myself, and it was just a really beautiful story and really rewarding. So
excellent.
Well done, Nora. And yeah, just a fantastic month. I don't know. I feel like a lot has been happening.
I hope everyone enjoyed the podcast. It's been great for this month.
Yeah.
That's our hour. See you all later. No, that is fantastic. You've obviously had a busy month. And I really love that story about your great uncle, because I just think that that's going to tie in so nicely to our next guest.
Yes.
And her love of her heritage and where she comes from. Hey, I've had a month too. I've got a bit of an announcement to make. I have been
quite... Do we need a drum roll?
If you got one. I'm moving to Sydney. So in previous podcasts, I have mentioned that there is some exciting news, and that is that I will be moving to Sydney literally in the next 2 to 3 months. Late Feb is when I'm going, and it is going, in one sense, for love to move up there with my beautiful girlfriend.
But also a fantastic opportunity to check out the artistic culture in Sydney.
That is exactly right. That's exactly right, to check out a different community. So it is time for a change for me. I have no doubt about that. You know, I look at it as a bit of a risk moving from where you feel like you've established yourself in some sense to check out a new place and new friends and a new job and all those things is quite exciting at the same time. The other thing that I've added to the mix of that for this month is I've just gone into shoulder surgery. So I'm sitting here with you right now, Lauren, in a shoulder brace, you know, on painkillers. Hopefully I don't start drooling on the mic, and I'm sorry if I do, Lauren. but this month has really felt like it's been one of those ones that really challenges you. If my life was a plant, I've kind of lifted it up out of the soil, shaken it a bit, and moved it to another pot.
Nice analogy.
Yeah, that's
like
kind of what it feels like at the moment. And what I have been facing is these physical and mental barriers. And there's nothing like that when you injure yourself or when you find yourself completely moving to a new city, is to challenge all the beliefs that you have at the very core of who you are and that idea of who am I. And I must admit, during that process, I have felt a little bit helpless. Only a couple of days ago, I watched a fantastic TED Talk with a lady named Amanda Palmer from the Dresden Dolls. And she does a fantastic talk called The Art of Asking. And she particularly talks about it in relation to the artist and fan relationship.
Yeah.
But I wanted to talk a bit more broadly about this idea of asking. Often I'm a person who is independent. I like to do things in my own way. And I don't mind helping people along the way if that's what I need to do. But when the shoe is on the other foot, I find it very hard to accept help. I tend to find it a little bit shameful sometimes to ask for help, and I'm not sure where that's come from. But what I have noticed lately, having my shoulder in a sling and my whole life changing in a lot of ways, is you do need to ask people sometimes for help, whether it be a mate about a job in Sydney, whether it be as simple as turning a knob to open a door when you've got your shoulder in a sling.
Yep.
Sometimes these things need to happen and you need to allow yourself to ask those questions. Because, you know, the thing is, generally people are more than willing to help you. People are more than willing to help if you ask the question. And I think that's something that if people are feeling like they're not in a great space with their performance or with life in general, just remember to ask, because people are generally very helpful.
Because you can often feel really isolated, but it's unnecessary.
That's right. So I think that's what I wanted to impart, this piece of knowledge that I've sort of found this month, and I'm trying to adapt it to my life right at this moment and see how I can at least ask the question in some respects to make sure that I'm supported in what I do for the next 2 to 3 months.
Yeah. And for anyone who's concerned about the future of the podcast,
oh God,
do not be afraid. We're very excited about the idea that I'll be in Melbourne and Nick will be in Sydney. And
it opens some doors, actually. We've got the technology that allows us to record from anywhere, so it'll open some doors where we will be able to probably meet with a few more artists than we have been currently and all around Australia.
Shall we talk about...
I'm excited about this one.
Yes.
Our storyteller is...
We're about to talk to Helen Duncan. She's a director and choreographer. I won't tell you too much because she's about to tell you all about herself. So here we go. Podcast 11.
Enjoy.
So we are here today in the wonderful Creative Behaviours space with dancer, director and choreographer... Helen Duncan. Hi, Helen.
Hello. Hello.
How are you today?
I'm nervous.
Nervous?
But good.
Yeah,
yes.
Feeling good about this?
Yeah.
This is a beautiful space. I mean, it's hard to feel nervous in this space. It feels very cohesive to good working environment, doesn't it?
Oh, it's a lovely working environment. I mean, there's just so much light in here. It's really conducive to creativity and...
Sounding good on podcasts.
Sounding good on podcasts, everything. It's
and you,
great.
You've done a little bit of work to this because I've been to this space before and you've created a dance space within this work area as well, haven't you?
My husband created me a beautiful dance floor.
Lovely.
Before we were married, that was my wedding gift.
He had crafted. That sealed the deal?
Yeah, he carried like hundreds of kilos of wood up the stairs and
good on him.
Laid them
and
on the floor.
And those are quite some stairs out there.
Yes. so now I have this beautiful handcrafted dance floor.
Fantastic. So to get started, we might get you to read us your story, Helen, and go from there.
Okay, sure. I grew up on a number of sheep stations in the remote northwest of Australia. There were no mobile phones or internet back then, and living remote meant living disconnected. The adults surrounding me often seemed quite hard and rough, and to my mind, this isolation partly explains this. Life was about survival. Emotional sensitivity was not high on the agenda. The recipe for a quality life in the outback was very much defined by your ability to find humour in anything and everything. I remember a lot of swearing and anger, but I also remember bucket loads of raucous laughter. This country sensibility and humour has stuck with me, and I'm aware of its strong influence on my work. I went to boarding school in Perth when I was 11 and developed tastes for the urban life. It took a while to reconcile these two different places of belonging. And after graduating high school, I spent a good 5 years wandering without a clear direction. I fell into a job teaching drama at a dance school when I was 22, and the school asked if I might like to participate in some of their dance classes. So I stepped into my first class and was bowled over. I'd found my calling, and the aimless wandering stopped right there and then. I worked my butt off, and by some miracle and a bit of fast talking, at 25 I managed to grab a place in the dance program at the West Australian Academy of Performing Arts. Since then, there's been a good deal of emotional and physical battles, hurdles, questions with no answers, and a lot of frustrations. But I'm proud to say I now have a career that is finally gaining traction, and I'm enjoying a very full and rewarding life. I'm fascinated by human behaviours and tendencies and love structuring work that presents us in all our glory, our beauty, vulgarity, wisdom, stupidity and our simplicity.
Thanks, Helen. That was great. Now, I'm going to get straight stuck into this because I'm quite interested about where you grew up and the country life.
Yeah.
Because I come from a country background too. But I find it interesting that you still like to involve this within your storytelling. How integral is that in your storytelling now to still have a sense of that country upbringing that you had?
Yeah, I think it actually grows. The older I get, the more I return okay. back to it. It's,
yeah.
It's quite strange. I think it's more about the more I start to understand myself,
yeah.
the better work I can make. Yeah. And a lot of understanding myself is tracing a lot back.
Reflecting.
Reflecting back to how have I become this person? Why am I this person? Why am I attracted to telling particular stories?
Yeah.
Why do I want to use humour in my work? Why do I like things delivered simply? Yeah. Why do I care about audiences yeah. and general public? And a lot of it to me just stems back to just the simplicity of growing up in the bush. You know, there's a lot of things in life, in urban life, I would consider luxury. And
yeah.
growing up in the bush, you start to realise that, you know, food, water and shelter is kind of all you need to be alive and the rest is a luxury. So, a lot of my work reflects on not taking life too seriously, because other than those three fundamental necessities, there's probably a few other necessities tucked in there as well, but that very basic understanding of life, which I believe I got from growing up in the bush and being surrounded just by life.
Yeah. And using humour to cope is such a big thing in the country too, isn't it?
Massive.
So that's something that's come through in your work as well?
Massive. And I just remember some really hard times for the men and women. You know, I was protected from it a lot as a child. It was just about playing in riverbeds and running amok and getting yelled at. And it was just a lot of fun for me, but I just... when I start to reflect back on what it must have been like for the adults in my life, and certainly to justify and explain a lot of their lack of emotional sensitivity or like let's just get on with this, we've got a job to do.
Yep.
And it's honouring that, I guess.
Yeah.
Do you have a sense when you're working of that in a visual way as well as a practical way through the other senses? Like you've talked about the practicalities of growing up in that environment. But in terms of, you know, the Australian bush and the environment of where we work being urban lifestyles and the effect that has on our art. You know, you've talked about how you like simplicity and bringing it back to what's fundamentally important. Is that, would you say that's all tied together?
Oh, definitely. And especially that I think a lot of my work is intuitively made as opposed to academically or intelligently broken down. It's taken me a while to really actually try and understand my process and that whole idea of writing grants and getting how you make work, why you make work, I kind of struggled with, because all of those, I actually don't want to use a lot of the key terms and the definitions that we use in industry, because for me a lot of it's intuitive. So,
and often non-verbal, I guess.
It's kind of that whole lateral idea of lateral thinking. You know, if you're out in the bush, if something breaks, you just need to fix it. Or if you want something, you've got to make it. It's, you know, you don't just have shops to go down to it.
No.
And back then you didn't have Google to kind of go, all right, how do I do this?
Yeah.
So a lot of the time it was just about staring at something long enough until you went, I might try this.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden it's fixed and you're like, oh God, how did I do that? Okay. And so you rewind then and go, okay, I think I fixed it because of this.
I
think a lot of that is in my work too, is that it's driven by intuition. I just look at the problem and thinking, okay, how can I find a creative solution to this? And yeah, it's the intuition and tinkering that eventually kind of gets
it. And did you ever have a time where you did these things intuitively, but you didn't know how you did that? And then you came into a community where all this language was being used and you felt like you were somehow unprepared or ill-equipped?
Oh, without a doubt.
Yeah.
But the good thing is that the beauty of it is the training I received and the interaction with like-minded creative peers helped me to be able to develop some sort of language.
Yeah.
You know, especially with movement, we do use our bodies to communicate. So if I could just spend my life doing an interpretive dance and kind of get you guys to translate it, that would make me happy.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, and fortunately, I do need to learn how to articulate my creative thoughts. And so I think being in the industry is really, really important, and just learning ways of expressing it, it is very important. Yeah. You know, equally though, I coming into it so late meant that I was intimidated by that language. I did feel that sometimes it was a little elite. And so one of the artistic drives that I have is to always consider my audience. And sometimes that's not necessarily a sexy thing to be doing, particularly yeah. in contemporary arts. Mm-hmm. But it's really important to me because I've come into it as a grown adult with a formed mind, with all my judgments, my intimidations, and breaking down something that maybe it isn't elite, but some of us, when we haven't been involved, see it as elite. So how do we break those barriers down? Correct. And how do we invite yeah. people in?
And have the confidence to do that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah mm. definitely.
Well, we'll talk about breaking barriers down. You had quite a remote upbringing, and you mentioned this idea of disconnection. That's often, you know, a lot of artists talk about the hard times or the struggles or of their lives as really being a catalyst for their work. So do you feel like that's an advantage or a disadvantage, that sort of upbringing?
I think there's a lot of space to just, you know, there's just that space to have a lot of freedom, that you're not cluttered by expectations. I wasn't taught to sit in a chair a particular way. I was allowed to just play whenever I wanted to play. Yeah. I had a massive backyard. I grew at one point we were living on a gold mine, and I went back to visit it in my adult life. And we were living in, like, my dad built this little hut for us to live in, and it was just like a tiny space, like a 5 meter by 5 meter concrete floor and corrugated iron walls. Yeah. We went there, and I saw all these holes in the ground that went for miles down, like they were these gold mine pits. Yeah. And they were at the back of our little shed. And I said to Dad, like, we were, what, 3, 5? How did we not fall in them? And he said, well, you weren't stupid. You knew not to. And
so it's a good point, though, isn't it?
There's kind of a really nice thing about growing up with that sense, that sensibility, and then and then coming into all these rules and ways of being and these convention. Still as a child, I was 11 when I went to boarding school and started to get to know people. But I started to get to know people picking up this idiocy everywhere I looked. There was all these questions and these I did find a lot of it funny. I still find it funny. I still find some of our life's conventions hilarious. And yeah, and so I really like extracting that and putting it into my work. And my work can be, it is contemporary in nature in that it's often quite abstract. So a scene I'll make will be familiar, and you'll be able to identify any popular culture references that I've used or some humour in it. But it is a little chaotic, and it is a little abstract, and at times hard to piece the whole thing together, because I kind of saw... I see life a bit like that.
Yeah. It's just so, is life.
It's, you don't get to, well, we all have a beginning, middle, and an end, but our comprehension of that timeline is skewed and confusing. And I really like just popping that in and going, yeah, welcome to my world.
Oh, I love that. I love just how you threw in. So we lived on a gold mine, just like it was something that happens normally. You did speak a little about your dad there, but did either of your parents have any artistic things that they love to do that were in the artistic space?
Well, my mum likes to say that my oldest brother got her intellect, my middle brother got her looks, and I got her creativity and artistry.
Good.
I'll take that. Yeah, I'd rather take all three, but I'm happy with that one. It's an interesting question, because I think that they are creative people in terms of finding creative solutions to things.
Yep.
But, you know, my mum's kind of had a nice interest in the arts, you know, playing piano and that sort of thing. Yeah, I would definitely say I fell into it a little bit.
But different forms of creativity by the sounds of it.
Yeah,
so they
definitely.
Certainly are creative in different forms than what we would normally think creativity sits within.
Yeah.
I think that's definitely something we've been learning from this podcast.
Yeah.
The more we think about what is creative and who is telling stories, the broader that definition becomes.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, my dad made me an award-winning bat costume when I was in year four at the in Carnarvon at the local town shopping centre. We paraded around in our Halloween costumes, and he made me a bat outfit that the wings, well, I think my mum made it and my dad engineered some wings that flapped without me moving my arms.
Oh, my goodness. Without you moving your arms.
Yeah, yeah, no, it was just all engineered, so I just needed to tinker with it at the sides and then they would flap. So, look, yeah, deeply creative family.
I had a great upbringing, but I want yours as a second option because that is fantastic. Gold mines, bat costumes, this is great.
So let's talk about this idea of dance being in you, because it also sounds like, you know, you say that it sounds quite accidental, your role as a drama teacher at a dance school when you were 22. I'm really interested in the idea of what you think about things happening for a reason. Like, do you believe that dance was always going to find its way to you?
I would say so. Because it's, some of the biggest achievements or things that have happened because of very, very minor things. Like, I opened a community newspaper and it said we need a drama teacher, and that's what kicked it all off. And I think I had always known that it was dance, but I hadn't found what on earth I would do with that yet.
That would work.
So as a kid, you know, pirouetting on the kitchen floor and being very physical and, you know, being quite expressive physically as well, and I was very attracted to drama, and I did think that that was, I thought I was going to be a little actress, and that to me kind of was an introduction that, yeah, there was something that I needed to do physically, and at the time, because I didn't know any better, I really thought that was to be a young actress. And then when I, you know, took this dance class, I was just like,
something clicked.
Oh yeah, it was so emotional. It's so corny, which is also a bit like why I don't mind putting a bit of corn in my work sometimes as well, because life can be corny. I was like, I did this ballet class, and like we were doing a tendu exercise, and oh god, I hope I don't get emotional. I might, but like it was so pathetic. I did the tendu, and like this little tear ran down my eye. Oh, see, I am. Hang on.
Tissues.
Great. Yeah.
Because it was just so profound for me. I was like, I had this sense that something was missing, and it just kind of all went bam, found it.
That
and
sense was, of finding something and release.
Absolutely. Like, oh god, this. Okay, I get the confusion now. I get why I didn't feel like I fit into the world quite yet.
So can you talk to us about what sort of fast talking was involved in gaining you your place in the dance program at WOPA?
Oh, yeah. it's a usual, like, I think young actors know this story well about getting an agent and this idea that you pester someone until they give in. And now that I'm a real grown-up, I know how irritating that can actually be. It's good children to know when enough is enough.
Yeah. Well, this is quite interesting because I was about to ask you, whatever your answer is, would you recommend it? So,
yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, fortunately, I think I did clue into, okay, that's enough. So I auditioned the first year and just didn't get in. It was a bit embarrassing, really. And then I auditioned the second year and I didn't think I was going to get in. Like, I knew how far behind I was, and I saw all these beautiful dancers that already looked like professional dancers in the room to me. It was bonkers. So I gave up halfway through and I thought, oh, bugger it, I'm not getting in, and this is awesome. There's like this guy playing the drums and we're doing this class and this teacher is amazing, and I thought, I'm just gonna enjoy myself. So I just kind of gave up and started just enjoying it. And whether or not something came through there, I didn't receive an invite to the academy. I received a letter saying that I was put on the shortlist. I was over the moon. I was like, are you kidding? There's been a clerical error.
I need to check this.
And so I went into the university on the first day after receiving that letter, and I spoke to Nanette Hassel, the head of dance department, and I said, oh, I just wanted to let you know I'm really eager, and if a place comes, I really, really want this place. And she was like, okay, we'll get back to you. And then I went in the second day and spoke to Reyes de Lara, who was the second head of WAPA, and I said, I really, really want this place. You know, has anything come available? Has anyone turned a place down? And yeah. She was like, look, we'll thank you for your interest, and we'll get back to you. And then I went in on the third day and went back to Nanette, and I was like, oh, look, I just wanted to double check, just in case someone had turned down a place. And she looked at me and, like, took off her glasses and rubbed her eyes and said... I said, Helen, we've got your name on file. We will get back to you as soon as we're able to let you know and make awesome. A decision. And so I was like, all right, that was enough. And then I went back away. But I think it was enough just to, it really did show them that out of all, you know, out of all the other, and a lot, I was 25 at the time. So there was, you know, many other 17-year-olds waiting for their place. What are they going to do with their lives? Where are they going to go? And I think there was me at 25 saying, I'm not questioning where I want to go. Mm. This is it. I want to be here. And I think, yeah, that just kind of gave them the confidence to go, oh, look, let's just take a chance.
Yeah.
But I think when they accepted me as well, it wasn't, I realised later that it wasn't in the view of training and, you know, an athletic prodigy of excellence that was going to tour in the greatest companies around the world. I remember saying to Nanette after she let me into the program, I said, oh, look, I know I'm really behind and I'll work really hard. I might get emotional again.
Take a moment.
I was like, you don't have to preface it. You can just cry.
Yeah. No one can see it.
She said to me, she goes, look, Helen, don't worry about it. You have a wonderful basket of gifts to offer the dance community. She tears.
Yeah. Isn't that lovely? Although you came quite late to dance, you certainly didn't waste any time once you found dance as your career. What drove you so strongly to make up those younger days? Like, what was it? Was it a sense of lost time that pushed you to really move quite quickly into what you were doing?
I've had a bit of a nonsense idea in my head for a long time. Mm-hmm. This story of starting late, I kept mm-hmm. with me for so long, and mm. it was just rubbish. I needed to let that go straight away. Actually, it really got in my way a little bit, and because you know, that was a convenient excuse I found, but it wasn't the reason. No. There were many other reasons. And I don't think the urgency has been more about, like finally finding something to sink my teeth into. And this kind of emptiness that I felt from 17 to 25, having that disappear because I'd found something meant, like, maybe I've been too afraid to come up for air because I don't want that feeling to come back. So I'm like, right, let's just knuckle
just
down.
Keep moving.
And, let's get this job done. Let's do this. That's
beautiful answer.
That's probably a nice segue too. I was going to say, you mentioned emotional and physical battles, hurdles, questions with no answers and frustrations. And I just wonder if you could talk maybe about one or two of those and how you motivated yourself to get past them.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think it's a familiar story amongst a lot of young dancers that you're never good enough, and it's so detrimental. It's just a big fat waste of time. Like, just accept where you are and keep working harder. If you want to be a little bit better, that's great. Keep working harder, but take what you already are and do something with that now. I think I have to spend a lot of time finding excuses for why, you know, oh, I can't get funding because I'm not a young person in the arts anymore, so I have to compete against the big boys. And, I can't get in a job in a company because I'm too old and no one wants to take on. So blah, 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 blah. And it was, one day, I don't know what, I mean, my partner is a great influence on me and really kind of gives me some very practical solutions. And, you know, you kind of just need someone to say, stop you whinging and get on with it. Moving into this space, getting a space to work in was a big, huge change for me because it just removed all those hurdles. I didn't have the excuse anymore that I couldn't get funding or I couldn't get curated in a space or I had nowhere to work. It all just disappeared. So with no more excuses left, I just had to get on with getting a team of people into a room and start working. And it's just been, you know, that's been a massive shift for me. I've been able to, you know, maintain my physical strengths and my mental sharpness, and also invite other dancers into the room to do the same. And as a consequence, we end up making work, and it's just beautiful. It's really, get rid of the excuses, just go.
And I love that, because that kind of dives us into, this is a bit of a prickly question that I'm going to ask here, but myself and Lauren obviously aren't too au fait with the dance community here in Australia, and please answer this.
Well, we're not yet.
Well, we're not yet. We're about to be.
Yeah.
But please answer this in your own personal thoughts on it. But the dance community within Australia and the landscape of the dance community, both here in Melbourne and also in your home state as well. So talk to us about the landscape and what you see it as being.
Well, I believe in Australia it is... just like the outback, it is a tough landscape. It's really tough. It's so tough. You have got just an array of incredibly intelligent, talented, sophisticated young thinkers, emerging thinkers, mid-career thinkers, established thinkers, and there's not always an avenue for that expression. There's, you know, we could talk a lot about, you know, the trials and tribulations of lack of funding or lack of public support, or, you know, and all of that. There are a lot of people out there in the community doing a lot to improve that and a lot to get that going. But I would see that we have a number of companies in Australia that can present work very publicly. Mm-hmm. Then we've got a lot of independent artists who are able to present a lot of things very privately. And, you know, perhaps they don't as much support for them to market things and to get things into bigger venues. And so there's just this massive dialogue about, look, we're all here and we're ready to show you and, you know...
So there is a lot of that collaboration. We'll use this word, collaboration. How do you see it as far as the Australian industry on the world stage too? Do you feel like we're trying to work together as Australians to get seen?
That's a tough... I think we've got... There's still a bit of work to do at home, actually. Yep. There is a lot of support for established... Companies and established artists do try to support and help young and emerging artists. So with secondments in companies or, you know, programs that allow young artists to apply for space and for, you know, support and mentorship. So there's a lot of really great stuff going on in terms of that. But everyone, including the established companies, everyone is so push for time and push for money. So if you're a young artist and nobody wants to, you feel like no one wants to give you support, it's not because you're not good enough. It's not because you don't have anything to offer. It's just that everyone's resources are already stretched as far as they can go. And so, it's about finding, you know, a solution to that, finding where you can go. And then, the distance is a big thing because there's incredible things happening in Europe and you know, around the world, and we need to be fed by that. Our art needs to keep growing and keep changing by being fed. And again, there are programs that offer scholarships and fellowships for artists to go over there, gather the information and come back. But just more, just really more. Australian dance could be fed more. And equally, we could, with what the discoveries we're making here, they need to be shipped out. They need to be
the other
seen.
Way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Two-way communication.
I mean, and whether it's your bag or not, Australian dance has this incredible athleticism to it and this humour to it, and needs to get out there. But there's so much you could talk about and try and find solutions for. And
that was amazingly succinct answer for a question that was really rambling. So you did very well.
So that's really interesting because obviously, you know, you could say a lot of the things that you've just said about the dance community for the acting community, and I guess one of the ways that we try to get around what work there is available for us to do is to step into other roles to try and create our own work. And you've done that through your directing and your choreography. When did you start on that path, the choreography path and devising work?
Oh, I think I was always on it. I really, really wanted to be a professional dancer. I wanted to be on the stage. I wanted to be performing. That has been a real driving ambition of mine, and slightly a sad one to feel like, okay, look, that's not happening. What am I going to do now? And I kind of reconciled that one for myself, and in that I do perform, but I perform in work that I have made. And also I like to think that, you know, what if one day a theatre director does need, you know, when I'm 65, a six-year-old, five-year-old dancer who knows how to move, you know, and hands up, here I am, woo!
Yeah.
So, but in the meantime, let's just keep busy. And it was just this, it was this process of going, okay, well, why do I want to perform, and what's in that, and what else could I do with that? And it does come back to this storytelling. I do like the, I like to perform because I like the idea of being involved with something that gives an audience just a, you know, a bit of a moment to escape their own lives or to dive into someone else's, view life through different eyes, all that sort of stuff. And so, yeah, it was just about reconciling, okay, if that's not going to be as a performer, I think I could probably give this directing choreography stuff a bit of a bash. So I apologise that I didn't come into it with, like, massive amounts of enthusiasm, but I think it's just always been there, and it was just a pathway of kind of growing up and yeah, figuring out that I can be very proud of this as well, and this can become a career goal of mine. And
in 2007, you're invited to become the artistic director of City of Mandurah's Arts and Cultural Festival Stretch.
Yeah.
So you managed over 180 artists. There were many workshops, over 20 affiliated programs. And not only that, you backed it up in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
That seems like a huge undertaking.
More fast talking.
How did it come about, and what did you learn after managing such a huge festival?
Yeah, fast talking. Yeah. Seriously, I had
better get some notes on how to do this.
I don't even
know.
It's one of these things as well that's intuitive that I don't know how I managed to do it, but I did it. A friend of mine was laughing at me one day saying, "You just wake up and you decide, oh, I'm going to be a dancer. Oh, I'm going to be a festival director." So, no, yeah. I think it is, a bit of fast talking. No, there was a... they're a beautiful team of people at the City of Mandurah who really do like to encourage their community to get heavily involved in arts and culture. So I went for an interview. I'd finished my degree at Whopper and I was ready to just sink my teeth into something. And so they took a chance on me, and I hope that it paid off. I had a wonderful time with them, and I continue to get invited back to Mandurah to run projects and that sort of thing. Yeah.
Hey, and speaking of running projects, you were working with some of the kids yesterday, weren't you?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a... established a youth performance, a contemporary youth performance company in Mandurah with the help of the Mandurah Performing Arts Centre and their general manager.
That's another
Guy
thing
Boys.
You just woke up and did.
On a Tuesday. Yeah.
I think that was driven by being a regional child myself and just going, just wanting to expose a group of young people to the idea that you... If you're happy at home, great. If you're not and you've got this emptiness and this searching, like, here's a few options to take a look at. So that's what the company is really about. It's just introducing contemporary practice. So with the support of Mandurah Performing Arts Centre, we tee the young people up with some pretty extraordinary interstate and international artists. And so we've been helping them to make their own original work. It's a devised theatre piece with some movement in it as well.
Yep.
And so we were given funding from the Australia Council to first initiate that project.
Yep.
And we delivered this beautiful half-hour work that was really original and raw and fabulous and just amazing, all with the help of, incredible artists, writer Susie Miller, director Sarah Giles. Yeah, so we're accessing those artists has been pretty phenomenal. So the kids flew over to us this time instead of us flying to them, and we worked with them over 4 days here in Melbourne. And
that must have been a great opportunity for them to come to Melbourne.
Yeah, I took them out to Melbourne CBD on Saturday night. Yeah, they were losing it. Like, oh, there's all this graffiti and it's amazing and there's these posters and there's this nightlife and everything's still open. And
and you know what? It's funny. When I was growing up in a country town too, there was this wonderful program called Machismo, which I still remember, and it was about getting boys in the arts, and I still reckon that was one of the driving forces that got me into the arts.
Oh, that's
so
amazing.
It's funny, isn't it, when you have these programs, they are so meaningful to kids at that age and in remote communities as well,
so
that
important.
Probably don't get the access that you know, kids in Melbourne do. So,
yeah.
So important that these things continue.
I think so. And they're always going to be at some sort of disadvantage because where urban kids are waking up at five and getting, you know, dragged off to drama school and dance school and are perfect by the time they're 17 and are going for these places in academies and universities. And, yeah, these poor regional kids, they kind of latch on and go, oh, I'm quite interested in this, but they haven't been prepped and moulded for 15 years before they get to it.
Well, let's talk more about this idea of travelling with the aim of extending your craft. You've done quite a bit of travel through Europe, which you did in the late 2000s. What were your biggest takeaways from that opportunity to travel abroad?
Definitely kind of seeing things that I did like, seeing things I didn't like, seeing things that I was massively confronted by. But just the idea that, to my mind, my impression was no one was looking for permission to be doing it. They were just doing it. And whether I liked it or not or connected to it or not was a little bit irrelevant to them. They were going to keep on going anyway.
Yeah.
And so just this idea that I could give myself permission to just dive in, get my hands dirty and not be afraid of the consequences as well, whether it was, you know, whether it's stylistically what's suiting the community right now or whether it's not, or, yeah, just give... dive in, do it, show it, see what the reaction is and move forward.
And do you feel like this idea of needing to ask permission to do the work is more prevalent in the community here?
I think it is, but whether or not that's just my own personal journey of thinking that I needed to, it's always hard to, whether it's your opinion or whether it exists, there is something in there, I do feel like, and it probably stems from, as soon as you've got even a marker of an idea, needing to fit it into a curator's vision before you can get access to space, needing to fit it into a panel's idea of what is current now and cutting edge before getting funding. You know, I think all of that, it stems from it.
Yeah.
It all kind of circles around itself.
So we'd love to hear more about your time at the Northern School of Contemporary Dance in Leeds. How did that all come about and what did you get out of that?
Well, fortunately, on that occasion, it wasn't fast talking. It was the first time I looked at my CV and I had that I'd graduated from Whopper, I'd managed a festival in Mandurah, and I saw this job come up and I was a bit poor and broke at the time and thought, I can't keep working in the bars for £5.80. Let's use my skills for something. So I saw this job come up at Northern School of Contemporary Dance in Leeds, which is a Whopper or a VCA. And so I applied for the job and got that job. And it was great. It was working to help support the postgraduate performance company there who worked with, you know, a range of international artists as well. So I got lots of exposure to different artists and different work. I got to take class every morning before I started work, which was just
so
lovely,
nice,
and really needed that at that time as well when I, you know, just was craving more dance in my life. Yeah, it was just lovely to be able to network with people and also this idea of learning to articulate strategic thought and strategic ideas. That was part of the role, was to be able to formulate ways of expressing what the programs were doing and justifying for funders and sponsors to come on board to support those programs. And so that was quite crucial in helping me to learn the language that you just need to use for that sort of thing. And it was a beautiful crash course.
And what was behind your decision to come home again at the end of all of that?
So I it was just a maternity leave cover that I was doing, and actually at the end of it I was offered a job as a head of the youth department at the school, and that was pretty big. Like, it was a nice healthy job with a healthy pay packet, and at the time I was, you know, I can't remember, I think I was like 30, 31, and I was like, no, I just want to dance. I don't want to be stuck behind a computer. So it was just about going, no, I've learned a lot and it's been really nice to be surrounded by all of this, but I need to get back to myself and my art and keep moving that way. And I think I was missing, I was missing home, I was missing family and that sort of thing. But also I just needed to come back to somewhere where I knew I can earn an income from my craft one way or another, whether that was through teaching or choreographing or, so it was to come home for a bit of a... bit of an easy... Oh, that's bad. Not an easy ride.
No. But it wasn't an easy ride, because if we look at it, you've said it right there, dance, choreography, performance, production, direction. You've got all these strings to your bow, as I like to keep using in this podcast.
That's Nick's favourite thing to say on the podcast.
But how do you juggle all these things together into your daily life? And do you think sometimes having so many skills, does it help or hinder what you're trying to do?
I think it helps in the beginning. Just gather. Don't judge yourself. Just keep going. If you seem to be, developing a particular skill in one area, just keep going. And then if you find you don't like it, divert to the side. And then I think where I'm at right now is I did get exhausted by all of that. And I felt like I was spending more time in front of the computer than on the dance floor. And I was fed up with not dancing enough. And I've kind of, it's strange. I've been inspired by, you know, this whole slow movement thing about like having chickens in your backyard and growing your own herbs and vegetables and being self-sufficient and self-sustainable and all that hoo-ha. So I buy those magazines and I flick through them, and I actually, I'm not going to move back to the country and start, you know,
a farm.
Having chickens and growing your own herbs. Yeah, and
all of that. No, I'm going to take a pass on that. But what I do take away from it is this idea of slowing down enough so that you could actually be present in life and not moving too fast that you miss it all. And in order for me to offer any contribution to anyone, I've just got to slow down, take a beat, and bring... I'd like, to be perfectly honest, I'm quite interested at the moment in bringing far more quality into the work that I'm producing rather than...
Quantity.
And I think there is a place for quantity. As a young person... a younger person, when I didn't know what I wanted to say or I didn't know how I wanted to say it, I believe it was really great for me to just do it and put it on stage and get the remarks and cry when someone said it was no good and like, you know, puff my ego when someone said it was and all of that. And now it's actually about, okay, look, I've got a lot here now.
Yeah.
It's slow down and pull it in.
And I guess that was the question around focus, you know, and finding your focus with all these roles. So it sounds like you're slowing down slightly to do more quality work.
And I feel like I can actually, after 10 years, start to legitimately call myself an artist, because before I think it was all about just trying to, I'm not sure what was driving it, whether it was ego driving it, that I wanted to be the best dancer, I wanted to be on stage, I wanted people to love me. And now I don't really care. Now I'm like, okay.
There's a lot of jazzy hands happening here that you guys can't see.
Now I want to take a bit of care with what I'm crafting, and hopefully some people might like to digest.
Lovely.
And obviously it's a vehicle to be able to take that care. You've already mentioned the amazing Creative Behaviour Studio that we're sitting in. Can you talk to us about what the best and the worst things are about running a studio like this and what some of your goals are for the space?
I would say there's nothing bad, nothing at all. But that's also because I've been very deliberate in my intention with the space. So we hire the space out to photographers. Seem to love the light in here.
Yeah,
so
it's beautiful light.
We get a number of photography bookings in here, and that's beautiful. It's completely out of my industry. I don't understand the field that well, but the people are beautiful and fabulous, and they come in and they use the space and they leave behind this beautiful energy, and it's just you know, all the income that gets generated is helping to then go into helping support my dance collective and making work and sustaining the space. It's just been amazing. The dance floor is there and I can use it whenever I want to. And I have a team of six dancers that come in regularly, 20 hours a week actually, to come and take class and keep fit and make work. And it's just, it's really beautiful. But I've definitely moulded it to suit me, the dancers, and where we want to go. So it's not, it's quite a beautiful business model that it's not drive by profit, not at all. It's just about earning enough to be able to sustain what you're doing, and it's such a liberating feeling.
Isn't that a lucky thing to be in, where you're not driven by profits?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's fantastic. And I did want to touch on that collaboration that you are bringing in here. Six or seven dancers, did you say?
Yeah, it fluctuates throughout the year. So we've had a number of the series run every 6 weeks because dancers need that flexibility to be able to leave and go and do a contract or get on with making their own work. Or we have some dancers that also choose to stay on to keep this as their fitness regime while they, you know, focus on other things as well. Yeah, it's a volunteer initiative, and I audition regularly for it and welcome emerging dancers and established dancers who are off contract. And the whole, I mean, there's a trade back for me. I obviously get to work with really highly skilled artists, which definitely helps when I am trying to look at making work. But the trade back as well is, you know, we all take class every morning and then we work. And so it's keeping us, you know, physically fit, mentally sharp, I mean, able to respond as well. A lot of the times you go to auditions or workshops and you're asked to do some weird, wacky stuff. And if you haven't been doing that for a while, it's the most awful feeling to go, oh, I'm not sure. I don't feel confident to do that.
Yeah. So these artists that you're working with in the 6 weeks periods, you've recently done a showing of a development of work. Is that at the end of each 6 weeks you have a showing? Is that what that's come from, or is that a separate project?
No, it's the same project, but I just mould the outcome to suit where I'm at and where the dancers are at as well. So without too much rigidity on outcomes, the outcomes is just coming here and being fit and staying in the creative process. But the benefits is, you know, I'll talk to the dancers and I'll say, do you want to show your friends and family what you've been getting up to, or do you actually want to show industry professionals, or do you feel ready to launch yourself into a show in a theatre and demonstrate where you are physically right now? Yeah. And so we just kind of decide that way. So I've just finished making this body of work that I love, and the performers are so invested in it, and they're incredible. They're so good.
and you just had a showing for it about a week ago.
Yeah, we did, and just received so much positive feedback, but also some very constructive notes on where we could take this body of material now and where and how we could turn that into a full body of work, and what the audience picked up on, what was it that really gelled for them and held their interest. And I just want to keep building that. Now that I have something that's quite, I feel, got substance, I'll keep pushing that one forward. But equally, I could have done the showing and put it for a test audience and gone, let's just either take some of those ideas or start again. But I feel like I'm onto something now, so we'll keep going with it.
And something really interesting... Sorry, I just kicked you.
Take that.
We do that occasionally on the podcast. Kick our guests. Something I found really interesting that we talked about off-air after your showing, you invite a lot of industry guests from different disciplines, and you were talking about how you got some very specific feedback from people from different disciplines, and how that now allowed you to think about which direction to take the story in.
Oh, it was so fascinating. Just three really distinct different strands of feedback and advice that was not just from one or two people. It was from a number of people within each industry.
Oh,
almost said
isn't that
things
interesting?
Word for word. It was so crazy.
Wow.
So my theatre friends had some wonderful advice. Friends and family had wonderful advice, and then the contemporary industry had lots of advice as well. Mm. And so now, for me, I think it's about trusting my gut a little bit and going, I need to go with what's going to hold my interest the most rather than doing what I think would be stylistically right. And that's a bit scary because ultimately you are looking for support at the same time. You know, it's...
You can take it on board. Doesn't mean you have to action it.
Yeah.
So it's good to be conscious of in whichever direction you head to still have that other feedback in mind.
And why I've chosen, I think, to take it that direction as well. Which again goes back to this, if I'm stumbling over my words and I don't have the language to express what it is that I'm doing and it's coming intuitively, actually just being forced into that situation of like, well, here's three distinct directions you can go. Which one do you want to take? Or it could be emerging of all of them. But why are you taking it? And it's just helping to create that dialogue for myself, I think, more than anything. So, yeah, I'm really excited. I'm so excited to be developing that now.
And you're going to put it on for public?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, at some point?
Yeah, I'll do some research to find out which venues want me and which venues might offer me, you know, a nice, reasonably priced theatre venue.
We'll definitely let us know when it's on and we'll
when we open our theatre, you know. Maybe well, we
yeah, fabulous. Love it.
It's supported by the profits we'll from the it, podcast. But yeah.
I just wanted to touch really quickly on injury within your specific area,
yes,
which we'll call dance for now in contemporary.
Which will henceforth be known as.
Just because obviously I'm sporting an injury at the moment, and it takes a lot of your mental strength sometimes to stay sharp and stay focused. Mm-hmm. Especially with your discipline, injury is something that's, I guess, occurring all the time.
Yeah.
And you have to look after yourself. And how do you stay mentally strong if you do have an injury and it's hard to use your tool effectively?
Well, I think first I need to do a precursor and say please seek medical advice if you have any ailment, because I'm about to actually contradict it a little bit, and I don't want to lead anyone astray and have them worsen an injury or make it. So always listen to your doctor, physiotherapist, massage therapist, whatever.
Medical professional.
The best way to avoid injury is to work within your body's, understand your body's limitations and work within those limitations. That doesn't mean you can't push yourself and strive for excellence, but it does just mean you do understand your body and what it's really capable of and what's stretching it a bit. Excuse the pun. I think the biggest thing we have to do as dancers in this program that I'm involved in, being able to just train 20 hours a week has removed a lot of the pain and injury that I had been feeling from coming in and out of it constantly and just changing my body shape so many times in 1 year when I'd take on a project, then I'd sit in front of a computer, et cetera, et cetera. And then the last thing that dancers need to do, which I've just find that they are so brave and so strong for this, is also just kind of getting over it a bit. So if understanding what really is an injury and what's just a niggle and what's just a little bit of pain. And the older you get as a dancer, you just have to accept that you're in pain not just because you're an older dancer, but because you're older, and that just happens to all of us.
To everyone.
So it's just about getting on with it.
And preparation, I imagine, is huge in stretching and making sure that you're fully prepped for the work.
Oh, absolutely. Yep. But being strong and being ready to do the work that's being asked for you is crucial. It's absolutely crucial. And that doesn't mean you've got to have the biggest muscles on your body, but it just means that you know what you're doing with your body and you can trust it. Don't be scared by all of those little niggles and those pops and cracks. It's all just natural. It's your body. We're not going to be built to do it all forever. So just keep going.
Use it while you can. Right.
Use it while you can, yeah.
So we're coming to the end of our wonderful interview.
No.
We've just got a few last questions for you. I was just wondering if you could talk about if there are any particular storytellers from any discipline who inspire you.
Yeah, really bold, brave directors and choreographers and companies. So Pina Bausch's of the world, DV8, loving the moves that the stuff that Chunky Move are doing with Van Dyke at the moment. Like so healthy for our industry to be seeing such sophisticated, like, guttural work. It's just awesome. I could rattle off a whole list of names, and I probably should rattle off a whole list of names depending on who's on the latest panel. But basically it's just beautiful, brave work that is not necessarily trying to fit into anything stylized now. Anything human.
As far as people starting out in the industry, what advice would you give to them?
Definitely just go for it, do it. And particularly if you've been identified as a very talented young person, please know that you still have got to work your ass off, and there's no rest. You've just got to keep going. And you can have anything you want in this life, but you've just got to work and work and work for it. And if it came easy, the whole world would be doing it. So just be really proud when you're having your ups and downs that you are very lucky, A, to have been attracted into an industry that is just so much fun and liberating and a wonderful place to be in. Just keep on doing it and work hard and don't give up. Yeah, that's it.
Wow. That's it. Just all those things.
Yeah.
I'll take that right on board.
What piece of your own work has most resonated with you?
Ooh.
And why? Discuss.
And why? Oh, no. Yeah, I know.
Good. There it is.
So it was a piece that I made in collaboration with another Australian dancer choreographer, Quindell Orton, and a British choreographer, Sarah Alexander. And we just kind of stumbled upon one another in London one day and said, I'm bored. Do you want to do something?
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
And so we made this half-hour work, and then we decided, hey, do you want to do this in Edinburgh? And we're like, yeah, why not? And then so we did, and we met up with an incredible female comedian who I've developed a really wonderful relationship with since, Jade Adams, and we put it on for Edinburgh Fringe. And all of those things that in Edinburgh happened, you know, like low audience numbers and spruiking on the street in the rain. It was so much fun. And we had nothing to lose. We had like a box office split. So like we just went for it. And it was just the funnest time. The audience would come in and just start losing their shit. They'd just start laughing. And I was like, that's incredible. We didn't mean
it
for that to happen.
It was a comedy piece, wasn't it?
No, like, we didn't mean. Oh, I mean, no. We made it and we thought we were being funny, but it wasn't our intention. We just were trying to show like the nature of young women out at night, and yeah. And we didn't intend for it to be funny, and it was. And just seeing the power that has was so great. And then yeah. All of the, you know, all we put it on in Comedy Festival and realized, no, if you actually want to put something on in Comedy Festival, you've got to intentionally make it funny. So there's a lot of stuff that, you know, that I look back on the work now and see that there's a lot of development it could have, and I could pick flaws in it, and it's quite a, you know, it's a young piece, all of that. But it was such a beautiful thing to do, to just launch ourselves, to find this fantastic response from the audience, and just to know that you can, it's okay to use humour. Oh, it's so nice. It's so liberating.
It just sounds like this is, like that, why it resonates is because it sounds like everything that you value in your life that had it, this launching into things, this ability to use humour in a way that, you know, connects with people. So is that why it resonated with you? Just this?
Oh, yeah.
Just summed up a lot of what you're doing?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Like I have to have a relationship with my audience. They're just so important to me, and humour can just fix so much when it's all really bad. It's just a lovely thing to have.
And I also love this idea of letting go of the concept of art having to be perfect.
Yes.
Like yeah. Knowing there were flaws in it, but for the time when you put it on, in that moment, you said a whole heap, you got a whole heap of things right. It's not about the flaws. It's not about the work being perfect. It's about connecting to people. And then, you know, if you want to develop work, develop it. But just learning and continuing that experience.
Which is such a beautiful place to end on, because I know that there are some listeners who feel totally opposite of that. And so to be able to at least start to have the dialogue about that, and to like that could be your next podcast, you know. Yeah. Like it, I mean, it could take forever to argue that one out, but whether the argument exists or not, that you should be presenting work that's ready or not, I kind of just don't care. I'm just going to do it anyway, and that, you know, we'll have the argument about it later.
Awesome. Well, I look forward to arguing it with you more off air.
Helen Duncan, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast. Thank you for sitting down and taking time.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you for letting me talk about myself for like an hour. It was
lovely.
Cathartic and lovely. Cathartic, and yeah.
It is.
Yeah, thank you.
Can I just say, so much food for my soul.
I know.
It's like, just let me go and create art right now. That's how I feel.
Go, be free.
But I guess so many things I got from that interview, but one bit that I really connected with when Helen talked about her first dance class and just that moment of, you know, having this sense of emptiness and not really knowing which direction she was going in, and that moment where she started dancing, and that finding that moment. And I think the reason that that's important to me is because, you know, we work in an industry where it's so hard to have sort of fixed milestones, or to know when you've got where you want to be. I know that you shouldn't always be looking forward, but, you know, to know when you've achieved things or if you're headed in the right direction. So it's really important as an artist to have something, a moment like that to go back to. She talked about later on how it took her 10 years to feel like a legitimate artist. And for me, she was a legitimate artist in the moment. Yeah. In that dance class.
Yes.
But it's so interesting that we feel like we have to do so much work and prove things to ourselves and to other people to feel legitimate.
I asked the question about coming late to dance.
Yeah. Oh,
and
yes.
She did not want to use that as an excuse one little bit.
Yeah.
And I loved that idea of you just work hard from the moment that you've got it to be who you're going to be. And I love that idea because at the end of the day, it doesn't matter when you start. If you're passionate and you're doing work and you're getting it done, you are, as you said, a legitimate artist. And what's to stop you? And I love that. That launching into projects, there's a real sense of just get out there and do it with Helen. And I really enjoyed that. Well, that is literally our last guest for 2014, Lauren.
How exciting.
It's been a good year, hasn't it? And we'll have more gems in 2015.
And we still have podcast 12 to come in January.
Yes.
And then we'll probably take a little break to figure out
what
the hell we're doing.
Exactly. So, hey, talk to me. Have you got some recommendations?
Oh, yes. Well, I have one particularly large recommendation. I mentioned at the top of the podcast that I was in Queensland this month and that I went to the Brisbane Art Gallery and GOMA.
Yes.
And I want to talk about an exhibition I saw at GOMA.
Oh, please.
Which is the Gallery of Modern Art in Brisbane, called Spirited by Tracy Moffat, who's quite a renowned Australian artist. The exhibition is called Spirited. And when you come into the gallery space, the first work that you see is called Spirited Landscapes, and it's the text on the wall says it's inspired by her return home to Australia in 2012 after 12 years spent in New York.
Wow.
Sound familiar, Gabby Rose Carter? And informed by how coming home can let us see familiar things from a different perspective.
Yes.
That sort of combination of place and memory.
Lovely.
And I was like, oh, this is so on theme.
So nice, yeah.
But so this one exhibition that of Tracy's that I went into, it's works from across her career. But one that particularly stuck out to me is called Picturesque Cherbourg. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Mm-hmm. And it's six images of the Aboriginal government mission, Cherbourg, that some of Tracy's family were relocated to in the 1920s, and a lot of them still live there.
Right.
And they're beautiful images. She's done something with the colour saturation. They're particularly vibrant. Right. And so they look like they could be from a tourist brochure or a real estate brochure or something. Mm. But when you look closer at them, each of the photographs have been ripped apart and put back together so that they're essentially a collage of a single image. But none of the edges are perfectly aligned, so it exposes the sort of rupture of the image. But it's only when you look really closely, and it's this idea of the violence that is embedded, and just, you know, therefore the story that those images tell. Mm. I mean, there was some other amazing stuff in there. And one of the things that Tracy did was she selected works from the gallery's permanent collection that have a spiritual relationship to the pieces that she was displaying. And she'd often put them, she might have 10 photos in a piece, and she'd put an Aboriginal piece of art right smack bang in the middle, or a tsunami wave. Or it's like there was a connection for her, and it makes you think about how those stories combine. So I love that.
Now,
this is not my recommendation. Well, obviously, I recommend that if you're in Brisbane, head to GOMA and definitely check this exhibition out. But the thing I really want to recommend, you go through the exhibition to the final room, and there is a TV chat show.
Okay.
Playing in this end room.
Yep.
Which is a piece that she put together called Art Calls.
It was a TV show, did you say?
It was a pilot series TV chat show style.
Uh-huh.
And she Skype interviews with different artists.
Oh, sounds familiar.
Yes. Architects, fashion designers, painters, a variety of people. But the interviews are conducted via video call, and they're on Skype call, and they're presented on a split screen.
Yep.
So you can sit in the end room and watch them. And it was just fantastic. Art Calls has been taken up by the ABC. And so you can watch it online. The interviews are 3 to about 12 minutes long.
Yep. And where can you find those? Online?
Yes, I've got the link here. It's abc.net.au/art/artcalls. I'll put a link on our site.
Please do. That's cool.
The same thing with her work where another artist's piece was in the middle of her collection. One of the interviews, she talks to painter Abdul Abdullah, and he likes to paint at night and he often listens to comedy. And then she talks to architect John Mainwaring, who talks about how his work is inspired by filmmaker Kurosawa.
And so she's all about collaboration with artists and fueling the fire.
And how our stories interconnect and how they're influenced by different cultures and different places and backgrounds. And I just,
She'd be right in with our crew, wouldn't she?
Yeah, we'll have to see if we can get her on board. So my recommendation for them for the month is this Art Calls project, and I'll put all the relevant info up.
Fantastic. I love it. Got a couple of recommendations for you too.
Yes.
So one is a fantastic possible campaign that I think people should get behind. Fee and Me by Diana Nguyen.
Can you spell that?
Fee and Me is P-H-I ampersand Me.
Oh, M-R-M-E. Right. Okay. Yep.
It is basically a Melbourne-based comedy theatre show that explores the Australian and Vietnamese intergeneration idea. It's about a teenage boy, Phi Nguyen, growing up with Australian-Vietnamese mother, Kim Hong. It is fantastic. It's been running in various forms through fringes and comedy festivals for the past 3 to 4 years.
Oh, wow. So it's being continually developed?
Continually developed. They've done all kinds of shows outside of that, and they're finally wanting to basically diversify the Australian mainstream media. And the first step of that is getting a web series. So they're looking for money. And I know Diana personally. She's a fantastic comedic actor.
Yeah.
And, I mean, she's grown up in this lifestyle, so she gets it, the nuances of the whole Vietnamese-Australian community and family. So it is just beautifully funny and beautifully appropriate for, I think, our media.
That sounds fascinating.
It really is. So go and support it. You can support it via the website, which is www.feeandme.com.au. And you'll find the possible campaign through the website.
What's the month ahead looking like?
Well, I'm obviously recovering, Lauren, so I'm spending the time to try and get out of the spotlight a bit, you know, and recover.
Replant your plant.
Yeah, replant my plant.
The plant analogy. Yeah.
Exactly. But I do want to talk about something that's quite exciting. I am heading down to my country town where I come from, Kundruk, next week, and I'm looking to record my parents.
Ooh.
I don't know if I've told you about this yet, Lauren, but I'm basically taking the act of storytelling and applying it to my parents' life.
Wow.
And creating a moving biography.
Yeah.
I've got a heap of questions for them. And you know how your parents, you hear all these fantastic stories throughout your life of your parents, and they're so lovely, but the less and less that they're told, they start to fade in your mind.
Or change shape.
And change shape a little. I really wanted to get them down and documented. And they're really excited about this idea of possibly sitting down and reliving these beautiful stories and their life, I guess. And I'm really excited about getting it all on tape and editing it into something that they can enjoy as a son, I can enjoy, as a family we can enjoy. So I'll be doing that next week, and I'm really excited to see what comes out of it.
Well, I'm excited too. That sounds like a fantastic project. And a particularly nice time of year to be focusing on family.
Definitely. And I think the nice thing is with your story about your great uncle, that idea of amazing stories that are passed down through generations and just making sure that they're not lost over time. So that's kind of my month, as well as obviously getting over the shoulder. What about yours?
I mean, I talked again at the top of the podcast about it's that time of year where it's nice to take stock.
Yes.
At the beginning of the year, I did a lot of goal setting.
Yep.
And so I want to sit down and sort of be accountable for for how this year has turned out.
Mm-hmm.
And then in January, I'm going to be doing some more work, obviously goal setting for the year ahead.
Great.
Lots has happened this year, but it'd be nice to really be able to clearly see where I've made as much progress as I wanted to and where I haven't. I've got a couple of other exciting projects happening, as you know, because you and I are involved in one of them.
Yes.
I'm working on something with the lovely Andrea McCannon.
Great.
And life is very good.
Good on you. I'm glad to hear that your life is full, but not overly full as well, if you know what I mean.
So I definitely feel a little more centered than I have done in the past couple of months. So thanks for your help. Thanks for your don't say yes to everything advice, Lauren.
Lauren, I did want to finish this podcast off on a bit more of a sadder note, but I did want to also make this a bit of a tribute to a great actor that I knew that died over the weekend. The beautiful Antoinette Kerben, who is an actor and singer who I was lucky enough to work with on a show called The Uncommon Alphabet with the beautiful Elisa Tanaka King. She played a character called Poppy alongside my Edward in that show, which was basically two lovers brought together by a shared appreciation of Michael Jackson. And the reason I bring this up is because I think she was the epitome of that character. She was always smiling, always happy to see you, and always inquisitive. No matter what had happened in her life, she was always really excited to hear about you. Poppy's favourite song was You Are Not Alone by Michael Jackson. And as a fitting tribute to Antoinette Kirbin's life, or Tony, as everyone liked to call her, I urge you, please remember the importance of reaching out to those in your life who make it a little bit sweeter and let them know that they are not alone. Rest in peace, Antoinette Kirbin. That is our podcast. You can find us on the usual channels, our website, about.me, Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud,
iTunes. Everywhere.
Everywhere.
We are omnipotent. We are everywhere. Have a wonderful Christmas.
Hey, have a great Christmas and continue to join us on The Act of Storytelling.
Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.